Good morning.
Good morning.
It's very lovely to see you all here. I think all is the appropriate word. I hope there's no one who has to sit outside. It's cold out there. So it's wonderful to be here. I was here yesterday for a retreat with a lot of dear friends. And it was very quiet and beautiful together. And then I came in this morning and sat with a lot of dear friends here. And it was also very quiet and beautiful. I think we have a theme going. So I feel very grateful. I'd just like to observe, given that it is so full of people here, I'll remind anyone who has heard or tell anyone who doesn't know that we're doing these same talks every Tuesday now. So if you start to think, geez, it's crowded, it's less crowded on Tuesday because we started 2 weeks ago. So feel free to come on Tuesdays or come on Sundays. So today I'm going to give this talk that I've called Seeing the Whole, Sama Samadhi. And I think this is going to start out potentially terrifyingly academic, but I'll get to some stories. So bear with me. It should all go well. First, I'm going to give a one-minute summation of the first and most fundamental teaching of Buddhism. Three, do I hear three, four, four, do I hear four, five? No. Okay. So, according to the earliest records of Buddhism we have, the Buddha gave his first talk, and the themes in it were some of the most fundamental and consistent themes of his whole teaching career and all of subsequent Buddhism. And they are thus. He said, I teach a middle way between extremes. This middle way between extremes that I teach is the Eightfold Path, which is an eightfold mode of practice or living. The reason you should do the Eightfold Path is that there's suffering in the world. Suffering is caused by wanting things to be different than they are. It is possible to end suffering, and the way to do it is by doing the Eightfold Path, which is the middle way between extremes. So today I'm going to talk about a couple elements of the Eightfold Path. The first and the last, principally the last. So the Eightfold Path is, in English, generally translated right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Are you guys writing this down? So, to simplify, sometimes we break this eightfold thing into a three-part thing. Right view and right intention is realizing that they're suffering and making a commitment to do something about it. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood are about conducting oneself in a way that is compassionate, conducive to non-suffering, well-being. And right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration are meditation and taking care of the mind in a way that's conducive to well-being and non-suffering. So the first element, right view, and the last element, right concentration, are the ones I'm going to talk about mostly today. And I'm going to talk for a minute about etymology, because everyone likes etymology, I'm sure. So, the word that's translated as right, in this case, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and so forth, is sama. And if you look at a Pali dictionary, the word sama means, it will say, sama, adjective, whole, comma, complete. It doesn't say right. It says whole, comma, complete. And the thing is, it's kind of weird to say, yes, I'm participating in complete action. I don't know how to do whole speech. So I think there's just kind of a semantic difficulty of translating that. But the thing is, what's being talked about here is not a moralistic stance. And I think in part the reason we have right in our translations is that Buddhism comes to us through the lens of Western translators and thinkers who think of Buddhism as a religion, and so basically layer their moralistic ideas onto it. Regardless, what's really being talked about is a holistic or a complete way of viewing things, a way of speaking that's about seeing the whole, connecting to everything in the situation. So sama, whole, complete. And the first element of the Eightfold Path is sama drishti. Drishti means view. Any of you yoga practitioners may know that you practice asana, you practice positions of the body, and you practice drishti. You train the gaze to go to specific places. So seeing or sight. So the first one you could say is holistic or complete seeing. Seeing the whole. This isn't really how one usually sees things, I don't think. I usually see things like, why is that car in my way? Why is that person so foolish? Why are those people in Washington doing those terrible things? I see a little tiny part. My mind takes the whole realm of experience and narrows it down into a tiny little container that's made of my conditioned storytelling and preferences. But it is possible to open up into some kind of bigger seeing, a more complete seeing, a more whole seeing. Generally speaking, if you read old Buddhist exegetical texts about samadrishti, they say right view, samadrishti, is seeing that there's suffering and you can do something about it. Or in later Mahayana texts, they say it's about seeing that all things are connected and intimately interdependent. Or in Yogacara texts, that samadrishti is seeing that there is not a world separate from you, but that yourself is actually just a part of one unfolding. So then we have right concentration, and this is by far the wrongest translation, in my opinion, in the normal Buddhist literature. So some of you might look at your bulletin and say, sama samadhi. And sama samadhi. So sama and sama, guess what? They are in fact the same thing. So the word samadhi is constructed of sama, which means whole or complete. And di is means seeing. The prefix di, or the word particle di, is like vis in English. They're not actually etymologically related, but you know, we have visible, vision, and so forth. So di is the root of drishti, and di is the root of samadhi. So the first step of the path is right or complete whole seeing, and the last step is whole complete seeing. And we could say the alpha and the omega, or perhaps the be all and the end all. And why does sama samadhi get translated as concentration? Is generally all your exegetical texts about it in the Buddhist tradition say what sama samadhi is deep states of meditative absorption or concentration. So since it's associated with this deep meditative state, we call it concentration because it's kind of hard to say whole, complete seeing. But really, what we see through this little etymological investigation is that what we practice when we do meditation is we practice a holistic way of seeing, which is the basic viewpoint that is held up as being the best possibility for our way of looking at the world and conducting ourselves. And sama samadhi is usually associated with peace, joy, equanimity, seeing through divisions, seeing through the illusion that we're separate from other things, all the same things with which samadrishti is associated. Interestingly, another little I'm getting a little academic here at the beginning. So samadhi, whenever you see it defined in early texts, it's always defined as jhana. And the word zen is just a transliteration of the word jhana. So what we are a Minnesota samadhi center. Jhana, zen, just like Chinese people can't pronounce jhana, so they said zen. Actually, they said chan, then Japanese people said zen. So do we. So it's our whole complete whole seeing center. Now, you might think that if what you wanted to do was alleviate suffering, that the thing to do was to go and change the way you're conducting yourself, or make even better, make someone else change the way they're conducting themselves. Always more fun. And so effective and rewarding, as we all know. And in fact, it is very helpful to transform the way we conduct ourselves. And that's, you know, the right speech, right action, and right livelihood are really about finding a way to conduct ourselves that is conducive to whole well-being. Seeing that our well-being is intimately connected to the well-being of everyone else. This is not the way we normally see it. It's like, this object is inexpensive, so I'm happy. I got the inexpensive object. The reason you get inexpensive objects is that someone else is working for low pay. That's the way it works. So it's possible to see more holistically. And in that moment, just touch the fact that the reason it comes to you is through a big system that has a lot of people in it that have a different relationship to the cheapness of that object. But the point here is actually that transforming just the way we act or even the way we think, which is also good, right? Effort in the Eightfold Path, or complete holistic effort, is about transforming the way we think. I'm not going to dig into that, but that's what it is. There's something deeper. The beginning and the end of this path are both about transforming ourselves at the base of perception, below the level of conscious activity and below the level of conscious thought. What Yogacara tradition calls a transformation at the base of consciousness. Sometimes they'll say it's like in the Yogacara we say there is a dirty mirror. What we see is kind of a reflection of this mirror covered in obscurations, made up of our habits and our desires and our prejudices, that it doesn't allow us to see the whole or see things as they really are. And we have the possibility through practice to allow that mirror to become clear. You might say, well, I don't know, sight. Really, I mean, I just see objects. We all see this microphone. It's an object. That's sight. Let me talk about a couple circumstances in which we can see that sight is not so straightforward. So, I have to take a breath here because this subject causes me to experience intense emotions. In the United States, we have the largest prison population in the world, and the largest per capita prison population, and that population is wildly disproportionately contains black people. Now, in the United States, black people are stopped more frequently than white people. They are searched more frequently than white people when stopped. They are charged more frequently than white people when searched. They are arrested more frequently. They are convicted more frequently when charged than white people. They are sentenced to longer terms more frequently than white people, and so forth. Now, we can say there's a lot of reasons for this. I'm sure there are a lot of reasons for this. It's complicated. I mean, we have one word which sums it up pretty well, which is racism. But an interesting thing is some people who study it have been like, you know, you go and look at a jury, and it's like there's a lot of people in that jury that I've screened to see if they're racist. And they're like, no, I really respect everyone and I really value civil rights and all this stuff. Or you go find police officers who are like, no, I certainly wouldn't want to, unduly arrest black people instead of white people. And yet, they do. And yet they do. There is a misperception at the base of perception, well below the level of thought. And this is also true. They've done some tests where they I can't remember exactly how this worked. So, but they have people like view a video of a crime or something and then remember it, and all kinds of people would remember the person acting as a criminal in the thing later on as being black when they were not. Here's another one. Someone said, why are there no French horn players in orchestras who are women? What's going on? We have all these professional orchestras. There's a lot of women who play French horn really well. And someone said, well, I got an idea. Let's do auditions behind a blind. And lo and behold, when they did that, a whole bunch of women got jobs as French horn players. And the kind of people who end up running orchestras are not people who are going to be, I don't think, in most cases, overtly sexist. People who come up through the liberal arts tradition with a lot of training about feminism. We don't see the world. I make no claim to not be racist. I don't know. My commitment is to investigate the way my mind functions. To keep seeing. To keep seeing where I'm not seeing wholly. And, you know, we do this in meditation. We just sit here and we see our prejudices arise. Sometimes we just see some peace, and then we go, oh, I like peace. Guess what? That's a prejudice. You know, someone yesterday at the retreat afterwards, they said, I was coming over and I just thought, I don't want to do this. This is dumb. And then they said afterwards, it was just beautiful. It was beautiful being here with everyone. I was like, yeah. I mean, I go through dumb and beautiful all day. Up and down, dumb and beautiful. That's me. That's how we are. We're dumb and beautiful. It's pretty good. It's human. Judging. Prejudging. And that judging happens below the level of our choice. Somehow, this tendency can be transformed at the base through just seeing it as it occurs. There's actually some technical, psychological language in Buddhism about how that happens that I will not delve into. But mostly, I think most of the people in this room just know it's true. And if you don't know it's true, just try sitting and see what happens. You will see prejudices that you had, or tendencies to judge people, or to jump into the same emotional or mental boat, just not come up. Surprise! And it's not because you said, now I'm not doing that anymore. It's because when it came up one time or a few hundred times in meditation, you just saw it. You said, oh, here's what it is. This is part of the whole. I'm seeing that part of the whole is the way my mind tries to narrow the whole down into a little thing so it can fix it, so I can get what I want. I should have written some jokes into this talk. Does anyone have a good joke? We have this idea of the Eightfold Path, which kind of says you have this aspect of practice that's active, it's in the world, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and you have this aspect of the path which is more a retreat. Just coming into your own space, training the mind, being with the mind, the right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And this is really good because, you know, without taking some time to sit down and do meditation and kind of let go of all the other concerns, like when we're here on retreat, it's like we come here, someone else takes care of the time, someone takes care of all the logistics, someone takes care of the food, and the rest of us can just sit. We can let go of everything and have some retreat, have some real absorption in samadhi, in giving the mind an opportunity to do this whole seeing. But a funny thing kind of happens as Buddhism moves into China and takes on the delightful flavor of Zen and the nice textures of Taoism, is we begin to see these two things, a big emphasis on putting these things together so that what Zen is an active expression moment to moment of samadhi. And these are probably always true in a sense. You know, early Buddhism wants you to be acting out of this whole seeing all the time. And yet, there's something just about the language and literature of Zen that really wants to say, let's bring this whole way of being to the simplest things. And that's why we have work practice here in all our retreats, and we have work practice days, so we can have the opportunity to do the samadhi of the vacuum cleaner. That's a beautiful samadhi. Just being wholly connected. I've had some of the most holistic experiences of my life running a lawnmower at Hokkyoji. You know, this lawnmower that it was like real finicky. You remember these old gas mowers and you get in a lot of grass and they'll kill all the time? And so you have to give it the right amount of gas for the right amount of thing. And I entered into this deep, whole relationship with just the grass and the machine and the sky and my mind. I could see when my mind would want to become distracted. I could see it within the whole of that. And so, oh, here you are. Let's come back to just working this machine in the way that works, keeping everything moving. A samadhi of the lawnmower. Ode to a Grecian urn. So, you know, there's a couple old stories which kind of reflect polarities of viewing samadhi. There's, and some of you may know these. There's a story called The Young Woman in Samadhi, and there's another one that's often called Awakening While Cooking. And in The Young Woman in Samadhi, there's a million complicated issues involved in it, but I just want to point to one thing. So there's this young woman, and it's totally mythological archetypal tale. This young woman who's not supposed to be anything fancy, she's just a regular lay person, happens to be sitting next to the Buddha. And Buddha's right-hand man, Manjushri, is like, why does she get to sit next to you? And she's in samadhi. And Buddha says, well, I don't know, why don't you ask her? And Buddha's, and Manjushri's like, well, I'm going to have to wake her up out of samadhi so I can talk to her. And he can't. He like does his mojo. He can't wake her up. And then later on, some other kind of bodhisattva who's junior does wake her up. But so we don't want to get into why you have to wake the person up and all this. It just points to the fact that samadhi in this story is viewed as a state of complete absorption in your own, you know. It's not like, oh, someone asked me a question. Boom, I'm available. It's like, I'm in my own complete wholeness here. And this happens. Sometimes when we practice meditation, the mind will just be very internal. And that's good. That's fine. That's cool. The mind does all kinds of stuff. It's one of the things that happens. What doesn't happen with your mind when you're sitting in meditation? Let's think of what kind of drama that your life has that won't happen when you're sitting in meditation. If there are some, just keep sitting. You'll find your mind makes it all. So anyway, we have this view of samadhi as this kind of withdrawn absorption from which one would have to wake up. But on the other hand, there's this story called Awakening While Cooking of a woman who really wanted to practice the Buddha way, but was unable or unwilling or prevented from just becoming a nun, which she wanted to do. So she's like, well, I'm just going to do it here in my house while I'm taking care of my kids and taking care of my family, which is she was a householder. And so she was doing that, and one day, you know, she had been doing her practice and meditating and cultivating a life of compassion, and she was cooking, and suddenly like a fire kind of burst up, and she just entered a state of complete sense of her connection to everything in the world and all the suffering in the world. And she saw through it all and didn't feel attached to it. She just was like, oh, she realized wholly, with her whole being, that she was with everything. Or as they say in the story, she realized nirvana. And so this is a samadhi of activity. She realized her whole seeing in the moment of just doing a normal, quotidian task, taking care of something in the house. So we don't want to end up... It may happen that we have this deep absorption samadhi, and that's cool. But really, in Zen, we really emphasize beginning to see the whole in these simple daily activities. Because that's how we can offer it more to the world. We can realize samadhi, you know, when we're hearing our relative is like laying out the same incredibly long line of complaints we've been hearing 20 years. And instead of just being like, oh, da, 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 yes, yes, oh, I see, we can actually be present. Or we can be present to our desire to run away from it or judge them. Whatever it is, all those little things in life where we run away or judge, we can just see wholly that we're here. Now. There's not going to be some other now for us. And this cooking thing, by the way, for all you Dogen Zenji fans, throw your hands in the air for Dogen Zenji. Dogen Zenji's, he's pretty cool. Dogen is the founder of Soto Zen. And, you know, he had trained really heavily in the Tendai sect, I believe that's right, which is kind of very intellectual and really studied lots of scriptures, and I believe, I didn't look any of this up, he'd already received transmission in Rinzai Zen, but he's they're still looking for something. And he went to China because he thought they have the authentic Dharma there. And although his teacher, Ru Jing, made a huge impression on him, the two other people who made the biggest impression on him were cooks. And he, although there's no record of him ever becoming a monastery cook, he clearly just revered these people whose practice was just working in the kitchen with their whole heart and seeing how sorting rice was an activity of upholding the well-being of everyone forever. And there's like one of the first things he says in his story about going to China. He was still on the boat for some reason. He stayed on the boat for a week. When they came in, and this Tenzo came onto the boat to get some imported mushrooms from Japan because he wanted to make a special meal for the monks at his monastery. And Dogen met him, and the guy was like, yeah, I walked 15 miles to get here, and I'm going to get these mushrooms. And they talked for a minute, and Dogen just thought he was really impressive. And he's like, wow, you know, I'd love to talk to you more. Do you want to? You can stay here for the night. And the guy's like, no, I can't. I didn't get permission to stay out of the monastery, so he's going to walk 15 miles back with his mushrooms. And he's like a really old guy. I forgot to say he's like, he's Chinese, you know, 800 years ago, he's like 65. So, you know, people weren't living that long. So Dogen's like, wow, that's, wow. He says, why? You know, you're an old, venerable master. Why don't you do zazen instead of cooking for people? And the Tenzo's like, young man from Japan, you really have a lot to learn about the way. And Dogen is just blown away. Blown away. Cooking. Simple things. Tell a brief story about, if you like bodhisattvas, they're cool. Bodhisattva, what? It's the archetype of infinite compassion. Sounds pretty good. A whole way of seeing the connection of the world. That the difficulties of life are shared by everything. So, and this features Dawu for anyone who's at the retreat yesterday. We got a little Dawu yesterday. He was the student yesterday, and now he's more of the teacher. I'm just going to briefly talk about this, but Yunyan asked Dawu, how does the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin use those many hands and eyes? Dawu said, it's like someone reaching behind her head for a pillow in the night. So simple. We're talking about the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, who's represented usually as having 1,000 arms, or maybe, you know, 52, however many you can fit on the statue. It's hard to get 1,000, unless you're really good. And each hand has an eye in it. So perception, complete seeing, is unified with action. And what the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin represents is infinite compassion. So how does infinite compassion manifest through whole seeing and activity being unified? Dawa said, it's like someone reaching behind her head for a pillow in the night. It's not hard for Kuan Yin. She doesn't get done at the end of the day and say, ugh, man, I gotta watch some X-Files reruns because I'm toast. It's easy sometimes to manifest compassion through action because we're not busy trying to get something out of it or get something for ourselves. We're not caught by the narrowness of our view, but we're just absorbed and concentrated in the whole seeing. Yunyan said, I understand. Dawa said, how do you understand? Yunyan said, all over the body are hands and eyes. Dawu said, that is very well expressed, but it's only 8/10 of the answer. He actually said 82%. It's a mistranslation. I'm making that up. Yunyan said, how would you say it, elder brother? And Dawu said, throughout the body is hands and eyes. It's whole. It's holistic. Just complete. An activity that isn't about sitting around and thinking over and over about what to do, but just about a natural expression of compassionate action and perception. And this is something we touch in Zazen. Sometimes it's just like there's a little break in thought. I know you're like, there was like a 2-minute break today. Wow, 2 minutes. For just to be body and perception. Amazing. How rare and precious. To just be this body and just these perceptions. Just let that be the whole. I'd be thinking, there's got to be some more complete kind of whole where I would really, you know, be transcending space and time. But just body and perception. This just happens. And it's enough. Okay. So I'm going to tell one more story that's really different than all those other stories because it takes place at the caboose. Dawu and Yunyan never went to see rock shows at the caboose. Dogen did. So yeah, I'm going to tell you one more little tale. And this is a tale of me and my son, who at the time was probably like 14, we went to see the bands Fishbone and the English Beat at the caboose. Because I like Fishbone and the English Beat, and because he liked Fishbone. Anyway, so English Beat is, you may or may not know them, but they're from an era of music. They're kind of old-timey type of thing. Called two-tone. Yeah, you're laughing. You're like, I'm old-timey. Well, you know, I've got all these guitar students who are like 8. So, you know, when I talk about Britney Spears, they think that's like Bach. So we went, and the English Beat is, they're a two-tone ska band. So two-tone, so named, because the movement had a lot of integration between black people and white people in London, where there's actually a lot of racial tension between the post-colonial populations and the indigenous English population. So it was wonderful. A community that really valued racial harmony and stuff. It was pretty nice. And I think the music is beautiful. So we went, and it was just packed. Big, huge show. A couple thousand people crammed into this little place. And Rocky was still not taller than me. So we got up front so that he could see. And we were right up at the lip of the stage. And it was wonderful. The music was beautiful, and people were having a lot of fun. It was very joyful. And the bass player, I had the good fortune of being right in front of the bass player. And he was really excellent at playing the bass. And in this style of music, bass is really fundamental and important. One of the most one of the most important aspects of the music. and it tends to be really relentless. So the bass player does not get to, you know, like, go back and take a drink while everyone keeps playing, like guitar players do, because guitar players are kind of lazy. And so he's just, I think the technical term, killing it. So he's just killing it, just these beautiful. And it sounds great. I'm like, this guy is just a fantastic and beautiful player. And also, he is, you know, just dancing a little bit, and he's got this beautiful smile the whole time. And you never know what's in another person's mind. And, of course, performers perform. So we can get up on stage and smile whether we're happy or not. That's something performers do. But sometimes you just feel like you... It's worth projecting, okay? He just looked beatific. The joy with which he seemed to be creating what he was creating was spectacular. And absorbed, concentrated. But interestingly, there was no sense of him being withdrawn, nor was there any sense of being like, hey man, it's a party, check out my bad licks. He was looking up like, can you believe we're all here and we're all dancing like this and it sounds so good? There wasn't any, and by the way, I'm making it sound really good. It's just like, wow, amazing. But there he was, completely absorbed in a kind of activity that takes intense concentration, but available to everything. That's what it looked like. Who knows? So I was enjoying that. I was feeling really inspired. Now, there was a person in the audience who was beginning to attract a lot of attention. He was really, really large, extremely tall, very muscular, and also sort of overweight. I mean, like the kind of person who could play offensive line on a football team. And he was pushing his way up to the front through a lot of people. He was dressed in a way that seemed to carry a lot of signifiers of, like, I'm extremely tough and potentially violent. Now, I know from a lot of experience, I'm both a musician, rock musician by profession, and a recovering alcoholic, so I got a lot of experience in clubs. And I know that large people in clubs are the targets of attention, and people have prejudices, that they're going to be violent, that there will be violence around them. So to what degree I was projecting, I don't know. But it seemed pretty apparent that this person was interested in getting a lot of attention, whether that attention was negative or not. And a lot of people were glaring at him as he would push his way through different groups of people. And he was moving all along the front of the stage, which is a weird thing to do. Plus, he was so tall, if he got in front of you, of course, you couldn't see. And he was bumping into people and kind of glaring at them. And you could just see, you know, out of the corner of my eye, I'd see these people. And I thought, oh, yeah, well, I've seen this kind of thing before. And my practice that I have learned is to just let that be. I don't know how many times you've seen someone trying to break up a fight. It's like, you sort of look like you're fighting to me. So I just like, I'll let that be. But of course I have my young son with me who's not real savvy. So I'm like, I'm just going to always make sure that I'm between this guy and my son. That's fine. But, I'm just kind of a little worried, you know. I have many times seen something like this erupt into a lot of people getting hurt, people getting carried out by a big group of bouncers. And so it's less joyful. But then, you know, we're all just also enjoying the music, and I look up, and this bass player is just radiantly doing this amazing thing of being with us all the way he was, in a way that could only be possible with enormous practice. This is what our practice is about. Practicing so that suddenly we can find ourselves in a situation and just be unattached to it, but a joyful, supportive presence to everyone there. That's what Zazen is about. Anyway, so this guy got real close to me, and it was fine. You know, I'm just like, oh, he'll just... I don't need to get involved in that. But there was a woman near him, and it started to really, really escalate. And I was like, oh, my goodness, you know, is she going to hit him? What's going to happen there? This could get really, really ugly. And so I was just like, well, just Rocky can stay here, and I will get out of the way if things get ugly. And so it was really, really tense. You know, everyone around us is starting to go, oh, what are we going to do? And, you know, it's really crowded. I mean, I couldn't have reached them, but, you know, it's the pushing. You feel the force of the body's pushing. And suddenly this bass player just looks at the woman like a laser beam. Boom! And she's right in front. And you could see her head look up. And he's just like, isn't this awesome? Isn't this awesome? And I probably misremember this a little bit. But, you know, you get a little thing where it's boom. And you got to come back in. Well, he hit that whole note, and he stuck his hand out, and he grabbed her hand, and he pulled her on the stage. And he resumed playing without having missed a note. And he's just smiling at her, and she just turns around, and she's like, wow, here I am with all these people, and it sounds beautiful. Completely disarmed the whole argument. Simple gesture. Joyful. Like reaching, didn't look hard. I didn't see him spending a lot of time going, how am I going to resolve this conflict? He just suddenly saw it. It was in front of him. There was something he could do. It was easy. She got to dance on stage with the band. I danced on stage with the English Beat. And the security said, come on off. They didn't drag her. That's the way they do it. It was friendly. It was friendly. And actually, inexplicably or whatever, the intensity of the violent energy that had been flowing around this person, this the big guy, just dissipated. It wasn't gone. He was still kind of, but who knows how. Just in that situation where he maybe was feeling the escalation of the, oh, I'm going to get to, it's going to get exciting here. And what was given to him is this guy said, come on. Let's just do something together. Let's grab a hand. Let's do something joyful. So I don't know. I'm not saying this bass player is a Zen master. I don't know anything about him. But this story shows something about how we can do our practice. You got to practice. You don't play bass like that if you don't practice. And you don't learn to be with a group of people in that way up in front of them without just getting up on stage or whatever it is, just doing whatever your practice is over and over again, wholeheartedly, like the practice of Zazen. But it's through that repetition, which is sometimes very boring. If you any of you play instruments, you know it's like, oh, good. D-flat Lydian. I love playing that scale. Oh, good, a wall! An exciting wall for Zazen. Oh, I get a floor today! Sometimes it's boring, but if we give ourselves to it, the possibility arises for this beautiful engagement and absorption that can suddenly manifest in a perfect action that helps people without a lot of thought. Complete. Whole. By the way, it's already complete and whole right now. Lest we forget. Let's not wait to be complete and whole. Because we'll never be more just part of everything than we are right now. So we have a couple of minutes. If anyone would like to speak, friend, reflections or questions. Don't be shy.
Okay. Two things. Tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day, and at 1 p.m. at Snelling University, there will be a rally and a march. Check it out. Second thing is, I think Zen practice is necessary. It's occurring to me that it's not sufficient, because this kind of unconscious reaction that you're talking about earlier in your talk rarely comes up on the cushion. It seems to me that we need to do something else to deepen our understanding of ourselves. One of the things that leads me in to conclude this or to think this opposes a question. If Zen practice were necessary and sufficient, what happened to the Chinese Zen masters during World War II who were supporting the emperor? Was their practice not deep? Was their Zazen insufficient?
My answer to that is yes. That's my simple answer. But it's a good question. And I don't think any one way is the only way. And I think we all have an opportunity to do a lot. Also, if my health holds, I will be there tomorrow at 1 o'clock on Snelling and University at the MLK. It's actually a Black Lives Matter march, particularly advocating for a variety of things around dealing with inequities in the criminal justice system towards black people. So it'd be fun to see you there. I'll bet we could sing some songs. And maybe bring some peace. Best thing to do is bring some peace and some love, not some hate. Oh, yes, Stephanie.
I just find it encouraging that the two protagonists of your story, the old man, that are kind of a role model, if I may say that, and the bass player,
You should speak really loudly so they can hear you in there, but it might bother all these people, but that's okay.
Okay, I can speak loudly. I'm a teacher. I should be able to do this. I said that I find it encouraging that the two protagonists of your talk that I will kind of look at a little bit as role models. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do that.
Sure.
That they are still taking a stance. They're not so ethereal and beyond everything that they wouldn't actually side. The bass player sided with the woman. He could have also reached out and pulled the big chunky guy up, right? But he didn't. And the Chinese old man could have just smiled, but he said, "You still have a lot to learn." And so that's encouraging to me, because I'm sometimes not sure whether me telling other people what to do, which you so very wittingly describe, or wittily, because there's always the element of maybe start with yourself before you start correcting others. But somehow we can't not do it either. And that's encouraging, so thank you.
Very good. Yeah. Very nice. It's good to take a stand. It's even better every once in a while to take a seat. And then stand up. Both. So, I will say thank you all very much, and I'm hoping that Darla would share with us some announcements.